chilling in the Japanese skies. Set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't
watching anymore. Cebu Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of Cebu in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about Cebu Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Cebu Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in, and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial, and only on Cebu.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot pray.
This is KBOO Portland. And Cebu is an independent, member-supported, non-commercial, volunteer-powered community radio station. By making a donation through GiveGuide on kboo.fm/give, you're eligible for $4,000 worth of free and discounted products from your favorite Portland brands. That's right, from the community, just like the signal you're hearing now. Isn't that worth some of your energy? Isn't that worth an investment in your community? Dig it. Well, it's a little after 10 a.m., which means it's time for the Radio Zine, where Suzanne LeGrand interviews Lisa Loving about her book, Street Journalist, Understand and Report the News in Your Community. Suzanne?
Today, I'm speaking with Lisa Loving, journalist, teacher, and author of Street Journalist, Understand and Report the News in Your Community. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So to start, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about why you wrote the book Street Journalist and why it's important for ordinary people to understand and report the news.
I have been a journalist my entire life. I've spent my entire career in grassroots journalism, community journalism. In fact, I spent decades at Cebu, and I'm not affiliated with the radio station now, but I've trained a couple of hundred people there in the tools of journalism, and such incredible people, many of whom went on to long careers and incredibly impactful journalism in their own right. So I feel that one of the most important things that we could be doing in the world right now is trying to figure out what is the next chapter in journalism and news media in general. I'll tell you right now, Suzanne, we don't even know where we're going to be getting news 10 years from now. We really don't. So I had a lot of knowledge in my head. I worked for many years also with the Scanner Group Newspapers, which is Oregon and Seattle African-American family-owned newspaper chain. And one day I just thought, this is it. There's got to be someone who steps up and puts this information into a book format. And literally the whole thing came right out of my head in one clump, this whole book, which is really, I make a case for journalistic ethics because they're crucial. But also this book, what I love about it is it's just a simple guide to the basics of journalism. You do not need a master's degree, y'all. You don't need a master's degree. You do not need to be a rocket scientist to do this work. And the more I watch, I spent some time with my mom down in California, and she binge watches MSNBC, right? And, you know, it's propaganda. And the closer we get to the 2020 elections, I don't care if you're on the left or on the right, you should have your fingers on the pulse of what's real information. And that's my personal goal, empowering everyday people with information. We, you know, Suzanne, we spent so many years organizing our communities around the politics. And I think now it's time to stop and organize our communities around information. And that's really the gist.
You know, I think it's hard for people to discern what is true or fake, right? We there's a lot of conversations about fake news, and certainly in the internet we have a lot of opinion-based content, which is different from journalism. Could you talk about what the difference is, or what in your book you're training people to be able to both recognize and do that you would say is based in journalism and more truth-based information?
That is, I think, probably the single most important thing about what I'm trying to do right now personally. And yet it sounds really grandiose, you know, what's true and what's false. What's true isn't the same for everyone, right? I mean, we can all say gravity, you know, what goes up must come down. That's pretty true. But a lot of other times, what's true changes over time, right? And even how we judge what is truth versus what is not truth, it's not uniform across humankind. And I think these are really important things to look at and pick up and look in detail. There's no simple answer to that. You know, it's interesting about the whole concept of fake news and how the president of the United States of America basically has made a lot of political hay around the concept of fake news. Fake news has always been there. Propaganda is just one form of it. In my book, there's a whole chapter about fake news and what I call brain farts, which are basically the tricks our own brains play on us when we're trying to make important decisions. Heuristics are a research focus within psychology, looking at how we think about things and how we make decisions. So a lot of times we're trying to figure out. I'm watching MSNBC with my mother. By the way, I'm also trying not to throw any F-bombs right now, just for everyone to be crystal clear what's going on in my mind, because I kind of want to cuss a little bit. I'm watching MSNBC with my mother, and you know, one of their hosts is Brian Williams. He what is his show? The 11th Hour with Brian Williams. And this is a guy who pretended to be a war hero. And he was sort of busted about 10 years ago for pretending like he saved. So I don't remember what the story was, but he's kind of a discredited guy, but he's running an entire show. And he is liberal. So theoretically, you know, if you're a liberal person, you sort of want to support liberal causes or something. And yet that's not the whole story either. So in this current climate, when you're just watching the TV news and trying to figure out what's real, the farther the news story gets away from your everyday life, the more difficult it is to tell if people are lying or not. That was, you know, one of the first, the first rule of journalism. The closer you are to a story, the more likely you are to find the problems with that story. So as we're looking at the current political climate, and again, the lead up to the 2020 presidential elections, where almost all of our television news is telling us that there's only two political parties, that there's two sides or whatever, we know there's tons of political parties in this country. There's way more than two sides. If you want to figure out what's quote unquote true, or more, you know, maybe it's easier to figure out what's accurate, which it's not necessarily the same thing, you're going to have to actually strap on some protective headgear, because it's not always that simple. Sometimes it's our heads, our own heads, that are supplying the fake news, you know. The universe rearranges itself to support my beliefs. What is that? Confirmation bias, which is a heuristic. Right? This is the brain fart. But I think the more we study this field of heuristics, if you want to be a journalist, if you want to be an information factory, the more you study how people make decisions and how people take in information, the easier it's going to be for you, the easier it's going to be for you to figure out how to provide information or informational media content that's actually useful in people's lives. There's so many ways to slice that. We could do an entire podcast just about what is truth. Suzanne, mm-hmm. let's do a podcast sure. just on what is truth. But anyway, I know that was a long, a high.
Yeah, well, I'm interested in this idea of confirmation bias because I think what we're seeing with media that is advertising based and also corporate controlled, we see that people are served up the information that already confirms their own preconceptions and beliefs. That's the idea of confirmation bias. And of course, in the internet age, that has kind of been built into the code, so to speak, right? So
it's
we
built into the profit margin, if you want to be super specific about it.
Yeah, can you
it's
talk a little bit about that?
It's all about the money. You know, I was talking with some people today about a national alternative news broadcast. And one of the people I was talking to talked about how, you know, well, if you're trying to serve information to the Pacifica broadcast network, you're going to have to give them different information than the people that you would give to a more general listenership of news information. And that comment started a little argument. But what's really interesting and remarkable about that is that Pacifica is a nonprofit news and information entity that was created to empower people on the grassroots level with information, as opposed to, let's just take, I don't know, as an example, Facebook or MSNBC, which were created to make a profit for somebody. I mean, one place you can start is you can figure out what is the goal of this entity. Sure, I mean, you know, community and public radio and media stations have to do fundraising, but that's different than the entire purpose of it is to make money. And honestly, when you look at, I want to say this too, talking about what is truth, what motivates media outlets, how do we take a machete and cut through the BS? This book that was recently written by Ronan Farrell about the Henry Weinstein scandal, it's called, what is this book called again? I'm trying to remember the name. Anyway, this book is remarkable because it's about the Harvey Weinstein scandal, but it's really about how NBC, the network, screwed up their coverage of it, and how the higher-ups at NBC were manipulated by the money from the Weinstein machine. And I really want to strongly encourage anyone who's interested in modern media to read that book.
It's called Catch and Kill.
Catch and Kill. The phrase means when the Inquirer purchased the rights to a story that was about how a sex worker had a settlement from the President of the United States of America to cover up their affair, their extramarital affair. The Inquirer bought that story so that they could kill it. So they caught the story and killed it. And that's kind of basically what NBC tried to do in the long term with the Weinstein story. So as we're trying to figure out what's real and what's not, the one thing you can do is look at the media outlet that you're taking in right now and figure out what their goal is, what their mission is. And when the bigger it gets, the worse it gets. I mean, when it comes to getting information that can actually help you live your life today. I think that another thing that's happening in the bigger picture when you look at media innovation and these, you know, I'm going to say shrinking numbers of actual paid journalists on the street. That is a major issue right now. There's so many fewer media outlets nationwide than there used to be that people cannot get basic information about what's going on in their communities. And I want to say this, when it comes to what is truth and what is fake news, I just want to talk about what kind of information do we need? Right, as opposed to, you know, what did the president say or not say today? It's huge. The guy's we're talking about all of these issues right now within the framework of, I'm just going to say it, an emerging dictatorship. We've got an emerging dictatorship in the United States right now. This is the high burner underneath all these other issues that we're talking about. It makes it difficult for us even to part these things, to parse these questions, because we don't have any idea what Donald J. Trump is going to do. We know he's probably already cheating on the election. He cheated on the last election. And meanwhile, you know, our main media that most people listen to aren't really covering that. And Facebook, right? Facebook, which is the information platform, it's, you know, the gigantic information platform, which has all but destroyed media, I'm going to say news media in the United States and increasingly in other parts of the world. Facebook actually makes more money from people gaming their ad system. So Facebook actually is not, it's not really an informational platform. It's a gigantic shopper. It's a gigantic shopping vortex that feeds people buttons to buy things now. And I mean, yeah, I'm going to be talking about this for the rest of my life, but I'm wrapping this comment up right now. These are crucial times.
Yes.
In our culture and around the world.
So one thing that's interesting about Facebook and, you know, what you were talking about with MSN is that they are private for profit or corporately owned, supposedly information outlets, but not really. Do street journalists or do citizen journalists have an advantage given that they are not by and large paid to deliver news?
I know, I'm taking a deep breath. No, no, no. The only thing that you can say is that news actually percolates up from the grassroots. It doesn't rain down from the ivory tower. We often think, as individual human beings, that news is just something we consume, like, you know, whatever, like Cheese Whiz on a cracker. But news is actually something that we move. It's something that we create. So Street Journalist is the name of my book. Citizen journalist is not a term I personally use, although it's used in a few other countries. A few other countries that even talk about this are freaking England and Pakistan, okay? There's hardly any countries where this concept of empowering everyday people and finding new avenues to train people in the tools of journalism besides graduate school, right? There's few places where people are talking about that, even though it's an ancient thing. So one thing that we can say is everyday people who, and I mean, I think everyone should be paid. I mean, we talk about how do we leverage the money to pay grassroots reporters is a big ass deal. And I think I can say that on the radio, right? So I don't think that anyone who's unpaid has an advantage in the news arena, just as across the board. Part of the issue that independent grassroots media has is in figuring out how to liberate the money from the top, right? Because that's where it is. And there's plenty of people, there's plenty of everyday people who don't have a lot of money that pay money for entertainment and activities, right? There's a lot of people that pay a lot of money to play games online. One of the things that we have to do is convince each other, convince all of us that it's worth investing in information. And we used to have subscriptions to our daily newspaper, you know? You didn't have to be rich to have a subscription to the daily newspaper. So when it comes to this issue of who's paid and who's unpaid, that's one of the biggest issues around. Because especially people who went through graduate school, people who went to journalism school, virtually all the people that have graduated in the past 10 or 15 years have debt. So if you are in journalism school now, you're going to get a journalism degree, you think you're going to get a fancy job, there are not a lot of chances that that's true, right? Actually, in fact. In fact, I see this debated all the time. But I think that the real advantage, the most important thing, is something we haven't even talked about yet, and that word is innovation. The most important thing to know about newsrooms, oh my God, I almost tossed another F-bomb, thank you God. Anyway, the most important thing to know about newsrooms is that none of the major innovations in news gathering or dissemination have been invented in a newsroom. None. None of them.
What innovations Facebook, are you talking about?
Facebook, Twitter, digital, social media, all these things, none of them were invented in a newsroom. We need to spread the tools of journalism out to more people because we need more innovation. We need to weave every brain we've got that we can possibly leverage into how we're going to keep ourselves educated and informed in the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the most important, and if that sounds like such a daunting thing, you know, from my years in working in the KBOO newsroom, which isn't even very many years, The most remarkable thing that the KBOO Evening News does is it brings activists on the air to talk about their work. They talk about the issues, and then they talk about how people can connect with them. Now, that right there is something that doesn't happen hardly anywhere else. So when you see, there's tons of studies and research now by the Pew Center, P-E-W, the Pew Center, or, you know, all these different other think tanks about the impact of a lack of journalism has on a local community, it actually makes the cost of everything go up. It screws up a lot of institutions because no one knows they exist or what they're doing. So the real benefit of street journalism is just bringing more people into journalism and ensuring that some kind of innovation will happen.
So can you talk a little bit about how you got into journalism? You said you've been a journalism for most of your life, or all of your life you've been a journalist. Why are you so passionate about journalism?
Well, I have to say that when I was in the fourth grade, I had a teacher that just came out of the Peace Corps. The first time I ever heard anyone talk about journalism was when I was in fourth grade, and it was Watergate. They were the last, it's not the last time a president was impeached. Nixon wasn't even impeached because he quit before he could be. But this teacher just came out of the Peace Corps and he started ranting at our class. How old are you when you're in fourth grade? Are you 10 years old? 9, 10, 11 years old?
Yeah, something
anyway,
like that.
He was just ranting about how few people knew what Watergate was, but it actually went to the core of our lives in our country. And it just, he got my attention, you know, journalism. He got my attention. And then, honest to Pete, freaking Superman comics. And then I started looking at Superman comics. It was like, because I was 10, right? Lois Lane, who never impressed me. And you never saw what she was working on either. And you never saw, anyway, but I was like, you know what? I think I want to be that person. So literally, passionate teacher when I was a child that actually planted these seeds in my mind, which is my way of looking out in this world and saying, if you're listening to my voice right now, your passion could actually impact someone. And now that's kind of what I do. I take that same passion for it because I just always thought the world should be a better place, even when I was a kid. And I can't say why. I really don't know why. But then I always thought the world should be a better place. I don't know why. I always keyed in on injustice, even as a child. So when I was in high school, and I was a freshman in high school, my English teacher invited me to be on the school newspaper, which is the first time he'd ever done that. Invited. There had never been a freshman on the school newspaper. Mission San Jose High School in Fremont, California. And I just got to go back a few weeks ago and visit the school newspaper staff. My eyes are tearing up. Stop. These were amazing teenagers in this class. My high school newspaper is incredible. And it was incredible then, and it's incredible now. And I feel that I went from loving words and loving issues and the passion of trying to motivate people. I feel like I went there to this concept of just wanting to be, you know, someone who made justice happen. And here's just a weird aside. You know, I don't know if you're into Tarot. Right? I do too much Tarot, but I can't say that I always understand what it's about. But my card is the Queen of Swords. That's who I am. And my biggest failing is I'm convinced that the right piece of information will solve every problem. I think all of these have to do with how I became who I am today. I still make that mistake of thinking that the right piece of information is going to solve every problem. And that's not true either. Right? But I've always loved words. I've always thought that information. I love gathering information, and I feel passionately about people and justice.
Do you think that there is a connection between a good flow of information and different perspectives and movements for social justice?
Yes, and there's a number of different ways to look at that. And this is a fascinating thing that you just brought up. Traditionally in journalism, there was this concept of beats, people who were journalists who had an informational specialty. It used to be science writers. Those were some of my favorite people. I mean, almost every newspaper has axed their science writers, which just gets me right now. But when it comes to movements, so many of our movements, our social movements today, are actually kind of technical and data-based. Right? You got climate change. That's a science movement. You've got Black Lives Matter and police accountability. Those are data-driven movements, right? People are collecting the information so that they can make a change. And this is important because the wider community of human beings that live in this country, they don't have all the time to be experts in a lot of these areas. And one place recently where I saw this really in a big way impact people's lives was in what the hell is the federal government doing with vape pens, right? And how, what lousy, lousy media coverage I personally saw of that. You know, we live in Oregon. This is a place where people have debated the legalization of cannabis and cannabis products for decades, right? We have more knowledge about that here than they do in, say, I'm going to say Waukegan, you know, someplace in the Midwest, right? But when I was reading all these articles about vape pens and the federal government and people are dying, and it looks like young men are dying more than everybody else, and something vague about vitamin E oil, and then, you know, it's just all this extraneous information. In the Washington Post, the New York Times, the LA Times, everywhere, right? CNN, wherever. And no one actually, in the end of the day, it turned out that these reporters that I was reading, even in the Willamette Week, didn't even understand what the words were that they were using. When you if you were a person who had a health problem, or even if you're a person who's totally healthy, that was choosing to use high-quality vape products from your local cannabisatorium, you had no problem, right? But the way it was reported, every cannabis cartridge-making company into the same muddle. It was like there was no discrimination, no discernment. Between there was not even any informational article that I ever read about how cannabis cartridges are even made, which would have been interesting. Mm-hmm. And in the end, it turned out it was these cartridges that were empty, that were pre-labeled, that people were ordering from China, right? And then filling them up with whatever. That was what was killing people. Even now, I don't think that story's been well covered, but it's a classic consumer reporting story. And who's supposed to even be regulating that? Right? So, I mean, we can talk about movements, and in the past, we've said to ourselves, you know, when I went to journalism school, I got my first job. That was back in the 80s, and one of the most important controversial things that a journalist did was a woman who was a female reporter for some community newspaper, and she marched in a feminist abortion rights rally, and she was fired. Right? Often, I'm just going to put this out, women and people of color often scapegoated at media outlets for stuff like that in the past. Just really unconscionable. But I have to say, we as journalists are all part of our communities. We're not robots. And we're not, you know, brand ambassadors for somebody's media thing. So when you have reporters that are coming from communities that know more about what's going on there, it actually strengthens the media outlet. So as we were talking, as you raised the question, what does it mean, you know, to reach out to movements or people in activist communities to do the reporting? I mean, I think that if we don't figure out a way to bring in a hell of a lot more different kinds of people into journalism, we're not going to be able to get the information we need to be able not to be killed by a freaking vape pen or whatever is the next vape pen thing. So we really, when it comes to diversity, when it comes to diversifying who's contributing to the information pot, we have to be less paranoid about who's in a movement and more aware of fairness and accuracy in reporting, because those are our standards. And you can do it even if you believe in civil rights. You can figure out fairness and accuracy.
I have been speaking today to Lisa Loving, who is a grassroots journalist, teacher, and author of the recently published book, Street Journalists: Understand and Report the News in Your Community.
Thanks for having me. I am expanding the journalism book into trainings, and I'm holding training workshops out in communities. I've already done it all over the West Coast around how to write your rant. How to Write Your Rant is not included in the book. This is just something I'm doing for free because I feel so strongly that people in our grassroots communities need to learn the basic four steps for how to create a reasonable argument. I've traveled that one around a lot, and I also have a workshop in 7 ways to use your cell phone in journalism and 3 ways you should never, ever use it. But hopefully by the end of this year, we'll have some online trainings and video training. But yeah, my website is street-journalist.com. And you can get my book from Microcosm Publishing. Microcosm is fantastic because they have an entire sales and distribution model that rejects Amazon.com. So I strongly want to encourage you to look that one up. And hit me up. I'm on Facebook. Look for me.
Lisa Loving.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much. This has been Suzanne LeGrand for Disobedient Femmes.
And this is KBOO Portland, which is your community radio. It's for you. It's 10:30, which means it's time for Film at 11, talking the films of the past decade that stand the test of time. And this is my opportunity to remind you that KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Darkside Cinema, open every night featuring independent, foreign, and art house films. The Dark Side is located at 215 Southwest 4th Street between Madison and Jefferson Avenues in Corvallis, Oregon. More information and showtimes available online at darksidecinema.com.
Yes, once again, it's Film at 11. Good morning, Mona.
Good morning,
I am DK Holm, and this is Film at 11, which will someday be on at 11, we
Perhaps.
Hope. Anyway, after us at 11 is Pacific Underground, about